as a cultural heritage institution, we are committed to the preservation of information so that it will be available not only for our current students, faculty, researchers, and the general public, but also for future generations. We also realize, though, that new habits, if we can call them that, for many people have changed, and we are now relying on born digital content, which does present a whole set of new challenges for libraries and archives. And as I was thinking about this conference, I was reflecting on my career as a librarian. When I began, news was available in the traditional way, newspapers, radio, and television. And television was really the big three, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And at that time, libraries were able to rely on getting microfilm copies of major newspapers. And then over the years, a number of institutions, such as the National Endowment for the Humanities, provided funding to capture and preserve local and regional newspapers. I have to say, though, a lot of that work is still going on because there are newspapers from particularly underrepresented communities that were not gathered up. So that's an ongoing project. And that just shows, even in a print world, how challenging it is. But then, at that time also, TV news was hard to come by, although Vanderbilt started its news archive on August 5, 1968, and has been reporting, preserving, and providing access to TV news broadcasts since then. But with the latter part of the 20th century came cable and satellite television and the multiplicity of new news stations. But the biggest change was the internet, as we all know, which gave easy access to anyone with a network connection to both traditional and new forms of news content. And then the advent of Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and other social media changed the way people looked for news and really ramped up the set of challenges that libraries, archives, and other heritage institutions space to gather, preserve, and make news content persistent and available. So I was interested to read that this year, when the Pew Research Center did a study of journalism and media, they found that 62% of U.S. adults get news on social media, such as Reddit, which is the top one, Facebook, and Twitter. In some cases, it's by accident if somebody goes online and is just looking for something else or checking to find out what their friends are up to on Facebook. But in other cases, and increasingly, people are actually going to these social media sites to get their news. So figuring out how to preserve the born digital news media is not going to be easy, as I think everybody in this room knows. There are legal, technical, social, and economic issues, and these seem to get more complex every day. Just as one example, I would point out in the last week that we've seen how closely intertwined the entertainment industry has become with news. And I have to say that I'm glad I'm not working at NBC dealing with these recordings, untelevised, of The Apprentice, and struggling to figure out what should become of them. Should they be released or not? And what are the legal issues, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to figure out a coordinated strategy to save foreign digital news content as a record of our culture and society. This is an enormous task, much bigger than any one institution can take on. And fortunately, multiple institutions are already working on this. The Library of Congress has some work underway. Of course, the Internet Archive, the Center for Research Libraries, and a number of universities. And that's where I think this conference, Dodging the Memory Hole, comes in. I hope that over the next 2 days, everyone here will help develop a framework for cooperation and collaboration around this important issue. As Abby Smith-Rumsey said in her book, When We Are No More, How Digital Memory is Shaping Our Future, building resilient and ubiquitous digital memory systems will take time. It will require concerted investments of human and financial capital to model and test approaches. There will be near misses along the way, but failure can be very instructive. There will be social, political, economic, and legal wrangling as people and corporations scramble to secure rights and revenue streams before they even know which business models will support growth and which will crush it. We are still in the early days of the digital era. The best is not the only way to understand the powers and limitations of the technology is to use it. In the meantime, until the arrangements work themselves out, the opportunity for individuals to make a difference will be almost unlimited. So you have unlimited opportunity. I wish you the best of the next 2 days and look forward to hearing the outcomes from tomorrow afternoon. Enjoy.
Thank you, Jenny. And I'd just like to give a round of applause to UCLA Library, all the staff, and the members of the organizing committee for this great space and this great opportunity at UCLA. So, a little bit of housekeeping. You may already have found this out, but in your name badge, you have a schedule. Inside there, there's a little booklet. And if you don't have one, you can get you one at the front desk. That's going to help hopefully tell you where you should be and when. And it just is going to be something in there. It just past the hardware. Bathrooms, should you happen to need a bio break, you go down the hallway. To the right, there are stairs in the lobby gallery. Go downstairs, and immediately to your right, there's a hallway. That's where you need to go. So, anyway. The other housekeeping thing is during any of the food breaks, we are going to be inviting you to participate in voting and expressing your opinion, and we're going to collect those throughout the conference. So please do participate. That's it's important, and it's actually part of our obligation to IMLS that we get some work done while we're enjoying food. I want to thank all the sponsors, our biggest sponsor, IMLS, Reynolds Journalism Institute, where I work part of the time. Actually, I'm office there, but also I work for NMU Libraries, and then UCLA Library, we've already said, and Edutopia Institute. Thank you for great collaboration all the way along in diving the memory hole, Captain Skinner, thinking of the rest of the team, Captain. So, hand for our sponsors. I'm going to just tell you a little bit about, and I think the branding people at the University of Missouri probably should never see this because you're not supposed to do this, but the nickname of the University of Missouri, if you don't know, is Mizzou, and we are the Tigers. I had a sticker on the back of my car. One time, somebody pulled up next to me and said, in a Cadillac convertible, and said, "Hi, Tiger." Hi. I didn't figure it out for about two blocks. This is Ellis Library. We just celebrated our centennial at UMU Libraries. This is the University of Missouri School of Journalism. My office is almost visible, somewhere to the right there, that's where that tall tower building is. That's RJI. The reason for my position there actually kind of started in 2002 when a server crashed at the Columbia Missourian. That's the daily newspaper that the faculty and students of the University of Missouri put out each day, and they have done so since 1908. But the content management system that was in use at the time was obsolete, and the server was basically running on baling wire and duct tape, essentially, and it crashed. The server crashed, the software was so obsolete that we effectively lost 15 years of our Mid-Missouri archives from the Missouri. And that sort of thing gets people to think, believe it or not, which is a good thing in this case. The dean of journalism and the director of NU Libraries, Tamsin Cogswell, came up with an idea that we should create a position to try to save foreign digital news content. And we created a position that I'm lucky enough to hold, one of the best jobs in the world, digital curator of journalism. Who could ask for more? And as part of that position, we established a program called the Journalism Digital News Archive, JDNA. And JDNA is a systematic approach to a variety of different problems. And one of the ways we do that is through Dodging the Memory Hole. So that brings us here today. Here are the things that we are hoping to accomplish, and we have planned on to our panels, our speakers, and in our breakout sessions, especially, to get your input and try to meet these goals. Now, the first one is to create a national agenda for saving born digital news content that appears online. So we've started on that road, but we haven't specifically addressed that online part of it. So we'll be breaking into groups later today in order to accomplish that. The other thing we want to do is we want to identify stakeholder roles. Who should be doing what? And we've got a bunch of different people here, journalists, librarians, archivists, and technologists. If we get together, I think we can do this. And that's where the cooperation and knowledge sharing come in handy. This is such a complicated problem involving so many areas of the newspaper industry, or the news industry itself. Sorry, newspaper is kind of an outmoded thing, I think. We won't be talking about newspapers much longer. But news organizations and technologists, the content management systems that run the systems that publish the content, that collect it, and then archivists, of course, memory institutions, the people who are probably the most adept and understand best the challenges of keeping something alive and viable and accessible over time. So we are going to break out in one of our discussion groups. Eric White is going to be leading a discussion to examine news content management systems and how we can work with those to try to determine a pathway towards working with memory institutions. How do we get from where we are with content management systems to where we would like to be? I would like to celebrate the fact we have 14 student scholars here from all over the country and from a variety of different studies in academia. So we will be celebrating those people at a reception later today over at Powell Library at the end of the day. So please join us for that. And I think really importantly, during the breakout sessions, we're going to have you identify specific projects. And so we hope to come away from this conference with 15 excellent, fundable proposals that we can go to IMLS or some other funding place and say, we're ready to go. You just help us make these into reality so we can advance the real practice. You can really show people this is what needs to be done to preserve online news. So that tells you basically where we want to go, where we need to go. We're going to go right to our first speaker, who's going to be introduced by Martin Klein from Los Alamos National Laboratory. Martin.
So I'm Martin. I used to work here Now at Los Alamos National Labs, and I have the honor of introducing our first keynote speaker, Hilmar Gislarsson, and he is a self-proclaimed data nerd. I should already tell you a lot, I could actually stop, but maybe a couple more pieces of information about him. He works at a visual analytics software company called Qlik, and he has the best job title ever. He's vice president of data. Which makes me wonder, is there a president of data, and what does it take to get promoted to president? Aside from his day job, he is an investor at an Icelandic media company named Kjarnin. Did I pronounce that correctly? All right. He's also a board member of the New England Chapter for Investigative Reporting. And I met Hilmar first at the International Internet Preservation Consortium like half a year ago in Iceland. And when I heard him speak there, I thought we have to get him to this conference, we have to get him to this audience, because it's really great information to share. And if you think about data as frequently and as intensively as Hilmar does, and think about collecting data, extracting data, cleaning data, analyzing data, visualizing data, the notion of data preservation has to be on top of your thinking. And so I'm excited that Hilmar's here, I'm excited that he'll be able to share some of his insight about preserving news-related data. So please join me in welcoming Hilmar Gislarsson.
Thanks, Martin. Yeah, so as Martin said, my name is Hilmar Gislarsson. That's probably the most complicated part of the presentation. My name comes from Iceland, so that's where I grew up, and that's where the accent comes from. Actually, some of the stories I'm going to tell you are from Iceland as well, but they definitely relevant in the bigger context as well. So, like that. So what I'm going to talk about is kind of what's worth saving, and I'm not necessarily going to answer that question, but I'm it's in part of our advanced mode. So this is probably what I want here. So yeah, like I said, I'm not gonna try to answer that question, but maybe kind of get some of you guys thinking about what is worth saving and what is not worth saving, and do we want to save everything? And I'm going to start that off by a little story. So this is Dev Teddy. This is actually not a picture of Dev Teddy himself, but Dev Teddy was a teddy bear that my wife had when she was a little child. This was her favorite toy. This is the toy that she slept with every single night. This is the toy that went with her everywhere. We all know kids that have toys like that. Now, Dev Teddy was called Dev Teddy because his ears were missing. And he was worn. He was old. He'd been owned by somebody else before. My wife had him. So he was not much for kind of the grown-ups to look at. So at one point, my father-in-law is probably doing one of his few household chores, which is he's kind of tidying up in her bedroom. So he sees this old teddy bear lying around, and he throws him in the trash. And he's gone forever. And there was, I can imagine that. A big and sad event in the household, and still to this day not forgotten. Another story of my father-in-law is that I come from a country called Iceland, but the name is deceiving. So sometimes the winters are a little bit milder than we expect. So one winter, this is after I met my wife, this is probably about 15 years ago, there was very little snow. So we didn't have a chance to use our ski equipment that we were storing with my parents-in-law. So the next winter, when we come there and we're going to kind of bring out the ski equipment, we can't find our ski boots. And we asked my father-in-law, and he said, oh, I threw it away, it was never used, because it hadn't been used for more than a year now because there was no snow. So some people are like that. They just, they want to throw everything away. They don't like a lot of things in their life. My mother-in-law, on the other hand, is the exact opposite. Old knitting projects from kind of when my wife was in school were still lying around. She knows where they are. She knows when they were worked on. She knows everything. She kind of tries to, hide things away from my father-in-law so that they don't get thrown away. And that's kind of the balance of the household. That's probably kind of how it all works out. So the question that we really want to answer is, do you want to be more like my mother-in-law, saving everything, storing everything, not throwing anything away. Or like my father-in-law that only has these few, you know, absolutely necessary things in his life and would like to get rid of everything else. Now, just a little bit of a background on me. Martin kind of covered this, but in short, I have this title, VP of Data at a company called Qlik. Qlik is a visual analytics company, fairly large. In that, we're in 50 countries with about $700 million in revenue. My role there is on the product management side of the house, where the title VP of Data basically refers to that I am responsible for everything that happens before our customer starts to visualize and analyze the data. So how do you read the data in? How do you prepare the data before you can visualize it? Our big data efforts, of data management efforts, and so on. This is all on my plate. I joined Qlik 2 years ago through the acquisition of a company I started called Datamarket. It was started in Iceland, but in 2012 I moved to Boston, where I currently live, kind of building out the business part of that. And before that, I was actually I had another startup called Spurl.net, which was actually about allowing people to save web pages that they were visiting, save copies of web pages they were visiting, so that they could refer to the exact copies that they saw. So I've kind of been on the data side of the house for quite a while. My other interest, as Martin mentioned, is then in media. So I've never worked in media, but I'm a news junkie. After I sold my company, I had some discretionary budget. So I invested in this company called Kaplan, or The Core, which is the literal translation of that, which is the closest thing we have to investigative journalism institution in Iceland. And then Martin mentioned the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. So this here is the future-proof chart of data. So we used to have a lot of data. Now we have gigantic amounts of data, and soon we will have gargantuan amounts of data. I've seen this chart often with some numbers on them, but it changed from year to year, and nobody agrees. But this is future-proof. This will work forever. The point of it being that, you know, there is ever more data, and we've all heard this story. And it's, you know, it's data of many different types, and there's data coming out of more and more human endeavors than ever before. I think that maybe one of my purposes today is to kind of broaden the perspective a little bit on what, you know, what we have to think about when it comes to preserving data. So you have the web. We all know the web. We have the deep web that I will talk a little bit more about, and then you have all the other data out there. And where you might look at news content as something that's definitely sitting up in the web part of this, and just a small part even of that, I hope I can convince you that there are things that you need to think about, at least in the context of news, that are definitely not a part of the pyramid. But we start with the web itself. This is your turf. I'm not going to be the egg trying to teach the chicken or the hen here. So kind of, you know, all these different media organizations, how they work, you know, how they publish, the publishing schedules have been changed, how the delivery mechanisms have been changing, how the consumption models are ever changing, and so on. Earlier this year, so this is our former Prime Minister of Iceland. He was a pretty prominent figure in the Panama Papers that were leaked earlier this year, and that the International Consortium for Investigative Journalism did a really good job at getting good, a kind of large group of journalists all over the world working and digging out some of the interesting things in there. Now, the company that I'm involved with, the media company, The Core, Kjarnin, was peripheral to that work. We were not kind of the Icelandic partner for that, but I got to kind of see a little bit into the process. But what I want to talk about in here is actually more about the consequences of that and what that means for media. So on Sunday, which is probably the 3rd of April, the Panama Papers come out, and all the big stories are published simultaneously all over the world. The chain of events that followed in Iceland was so intense that the amount of things that were going on, the amount of meetings that were happening, the amount of news content, newsworthy things that were happening, were almost more than you could have covered in real time. So you could, you know, there were some journalists covering something at one in one place, other journalists covering something else in another place, and especially the Tuesday, which is I think the 5th, first of all, if you think U.S. politics are so ultra, this was definitely one too. But the point here is that certain media publications were covering parts of the story, and what unfolded and how things kind of how events played out will, I think, be something that people would be really interested in looking back at. So my point here is, it's not enough just to have saved all the stories that came out, but you almost need to know exactly at what point the story looked in a certain way, who published what before somebody else, and kind of change that all together. Because as things were kind of unfolding, as you want to look back at this day, even kind of just, you know, the timestamps of the news aren't necessarily, the timestamps of the news aren't necessarily something to be trusted, and there are also the things. So basically, on a big news day, in order to kind of properly capture the news, it's not just enough to capture every single story. You almost have to capture all of the media minute by minute basis, so that you can play back the way things went. So that's kind of a takeaway from this story. It's not an Icelandic phenomenon. So you see other kind of things changing as well. And it goes back to, you can't just trust that you can go back to a story at a certain point in time and trust that it hasn't been changed. So the name of this event, searching the memory hole, wasn't lost on me. So the memory hole in George Orwell's 1984 is where news went to be remembered forever, meaning forgotten. The job of the main character in the book was actually to take news, historic news, and change them to the liking of the rulers of the time. So this is a pretty famous thing that happened at the New York Times earlier this year. There was a relatively pro-Hillary piece that came out that was changed later on to kind of be changed in tone of voice, and somebody pointed out this difference in the news. It actually turns out, and this comes from a service called News Tips, if you haven't heard of that. So they do exactly this. They track the same piece of news over time and check all the differences. And it turned out that this particular article had changed quite a lot. And so once again, you can't just capture an article as it stands and trust that it will be like that forever. You only need to capture the same article over and over again to make sure that it hasn't been changed. Martin and I were actually talking about it earlier today, that if you, even the news that are there, even the articles that are there, so let's say that you referenced CNN.com 10 years ago, the piece of news is probably still surviving on the same URL, but it's obviously now probably in a different CMS system, it's in a completely different context on the web page, and even if the text of the story hasn't changed, some of those things can actually be important too. So there are also things to think about and consider here. There are obviously a lot more things to be said about the web, but I want to move on to the next layer, so the deep web. This is a thought that came from about 8 years ago. So I was lucky enough to be invited by the Icelandic National Library to talk about kind of their future strategy about 8 years ago. And this is when social media was very new. Facebook was very new, but you know, still people knew what it was, and they kind of started to understand that it was an important medium. And the picture in the middle is actually of Iceland's only Nobel laureate. So this is a guy called Halldór Laxness, and he won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1953. And my question that I posed to them was, had Halldór Laxness been on social media as a teenager, would we like to have his social media content as historians or librarians and so on? The answer is probably yes. That would have been interesting. Would he have liked that? Don't know. Would it paint him in a different light? Would it kind of, is it ethical even to kind of, would it have been ethical to kind of capture all of those things? And with social media, there's so much more things that are coming out about people now that, you know, the people that are growing up, even, let's just think, the, what was it? Was it 10-year-old? 13-year-old? No. 11 years since the tape that has been changing Donald Trump for the last few days came out. And that's in an era where you actually had to have a camera crew following you in order for something like that to be captured. Think about somebody in that situation today with all the kind of capturing of on social media, all the video, all the imaging, all the recording that's happening all of the time. Politicians, whoever, you know, they would have a lot more things in their recorded history in the future than they have now. The question is, you know, how easy is it to kind of get to that? What's ethical to say? What's ethical to bring up? What is private? What is public? And so on. These are all kind of interesting questions to think about. Another aspect of the deeper web is the fact that we as archivists can really get to the content. Some of it is hidden behind usernames and passwords, and you have to log in, you have to have access to those to be able to kind of capture them. But others are just trapped in proprietary systems that our crawlers or our kind of indexing engines don't know how to read or how to get into or how to query for all the content that is there. They're also often really large databases that we are then trying to replicate in a less ideal format somewhere else, and there are also the problems with that. Facebook is a very good example of this, where, you know, a lot of the content, actually most of the content that's published there, is not public, meaning it's relatively public. It's published to all of your friends or, you know, some groups of people, but it's not something that, you know, first of all, Facebook makes it hard to archive it, secondly, it's really big, and thirdly, a lot of it isn't for everybody's consumption. So Facebook is really the only company that, or the only organization, that is in a position to kind of even consider this, and I mean, they obviously archive it, they store it, and we can put their reference back to it, but we have no claim to be able to see that, but it, especially because a lot of news these days, as was pointed out earlier, comes from these types of sources. And when you're thinking about preserving the news, then, for example, social media profiles of at least public personas, you know, public people that are in the public kind of sphere, are they a part of preserving the news? Is that a part of preserving the news as well? Because even something they say now might not fly, but it might become really newsworthy at some point later on. So, again, there's a lot more to be said about the deep web, but I really want to kind of spend the rest of the time here talking about all the data that's out there. That's probably mostly my last two companies, Data Marketing, and now with Cliff. That's what I do most of the day. YouTube. So anybody care to guess how long it takes for 500 hours of video to be uploaded to YouTube? A month, a week, a day, hour, minute, second?
Seconds closer.
Okay.
Maybe a minute.
Well, it is a minute, so you are off by a factor of 60. But that's still a lot of content. It means that it would take three working, or three man months, three person months, to watch the content that's uploaded to YouTube every single minute of every single day, all year round. So obviously nobody will watch all of that, meaning there will no organization go around and watching all of that. Probably most of the content is watched by somebody at some point, but not even all of it. So what do we want to do with that? There's a lot of newsworthy content out there. We have no clue which parts are newsworthy. We can go off, kind of, again, we can go off public profiles. I will capture some of it, but what about that somebody capturing an event that's going on, published on YouTube, doesn't fly on social media, surfaces, and surfaces a year later, or maybe never surfaces, but could bring a new perspective on something that that's worth knowing. Again, I definitely don't have the answer to that, but it is something to consider and something to think about. And on that note, so I want to tell you a little bit of a story about data gathering. So this is a place in the western part of Iceland called Hörgjörgsviti. It's a lighthouse in the middle of, as much in the middle of nowhere as you can get. And so this is Iceland, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and up there we have Hörgjörgsviti. Almost everybody lives here in the Reykjavik area. And then kind of around the coastline up there, there's only this lighthouse. Now, these are the people that were the keepers of that lighthouse for about 65 years. And one of their tasks, until the lightkeepers were replaced with automated equipment, one of the tasks was actually to measure the weather. And one of the measurements they would take would be the temperature. So on May 12th, 1960 at 12 o'clock, 4 degrees Celsius. Then he goes out again 6 hours later and he takes another measurement. And temperature is obviously just one of the many measurements he's doing. This is May 1960. Every 6 hours, actually later, every 3 hours, he goes out and takes all these measurements. This is about 2 years. You can see that it was slightly warmer in 1960 than it was in 59. This is a whole decade. And this is just one of 200 such manually manned stations around the small island of Iceland. Now, imagine all the man years that have gone into gathering this data that can be really interesting for scientific reasons, for historic reasons, for even news reasons. Go back to and study how what the weather was like, and this is just the weather. There are also some other people that have either as a big part of their job or as a kind of outcome of their day-to-day job, some sort of data gathering, and a lot of this data is lost. Fortunately, most of the weather data, actually all of the weather data that was captured in Iceland, has been found. So we can found the outcome of these many years of work. But it was by coincidence. There was nobody that was really kind of thinking about archiving this as it was coming in. So just something to think about, that there are preserving data is actually about preserving the work of the entire working life of people all around the world, and it would be a shame to lose that, especially if it can be helpful to research later on. Another piece of data that when I started data mining, we started digging around for, was earthquakes. So earthquakes and eruptions are fairly frequent. Iceland is a volcanic island, and we have quite a lot of measurements around that, and there turned out to be an archive of all the earthquakes. It was not easily gotten at, but we started kind of looking at that and what could be done with that data. And this is maybe more to point out that it's not, well, it obviously helps archiving the data, but then the ways you have to look at the data change quite a lot as well. So you may remember, move over to the browser here. You may remember that a few years ago, everybody that was traveling in the Western Hemisphere more or less was stuck for a week because of a volcanic eruption in Iceland. This shows the chain of the events there. It so happened that we were working with this data at the time and created this video. So the way the video works is that you have kind of circles that represent magnitude earthquakes. There are on average about 250 of those in Iceland per day, so there's quite a lot of them. Most of them far too small to be felt, but they can be measured. And the size of the circle shows the scale or magnitude of the earthquake, and the color shows the how deep they are. So if we kind of play this out, we can see earthquake activity here in the early 2000s in this glacier. So speaking of hard to pronounce names, this is Eyjafjallajökull. And you can see kind of scattered activity all around the glacier for a while, and it starts concentrating, and you can actually see how some of the you can see how some of the activity kind of moves around, concentrates, and then you can see as it starts moving to the east. And this is actually, you're actually literally looking at the magma finding its way through the ground, and you will notice that they get ever shallower as well. And it ended up the magma found its way up through the ground between the two glaciers there. And the nature of volcanic eruptions is that if they happen on land, they just become lava and they are relatively contained. But if they happen under glacier, the magma turns into ash in big explosion immediately, and that's when you get these big ash clouds. So this was a small and beautiful eruption. A lot of people went up there on the beach just to look at it, and went then on for about 2 weeks, but the activity didn't stop. So here we have kind of a certain activity and the big eruption that happened at the top of the volcano. So the point here is, so this video actually ended up being licensed by the National Geographic, and they created a documentary where this was featured. But it shows you, it's just to show that you don't have the tools to look at the data in context or in a informative way. You don't even know what the data is telling you. So preservation is also about making the data available. And then is it our or your task to also provide people with some of those tools, or is that their task entirely, which obviously means that there's a very small part of the population that knows these tools or has the ability to kind of get to them in that way. Another example of such data is it turned out, so when the crisis in Greece happened, the economic crisis in Greece started unfolding, one of the things that surfaced was that the national statistics that their acceptance into the European Union was based on turned out to be wrong. Some say falsified, but it was at least not correct. So there were certain measurements that you have to, or standards that you have to meet to be accepted into the European Union, in terms of inflation, in terms of unemployment, and things like that. And it turned out that, you know, those were off. And they, you know, at least they wouldn't have met those if the statistics were correct. The interesting thing here is that the data that was published at the time, which is published electronically on the website of Statistics Greece, was nowhere to be found, meaning there was now a new database out there with the correct data. That's what you would get if you go to the website and looked it up. But there was no record, there's no digital record of the data, the way, of how the data looked or what the data looked like when it was published 5 years earlier. That goes to show that, first of all, the website was probably archived by the Internet Archive and probably some others as well, but they didn't see into the system, they didn't see into the data that was being published on the website. The only way to recreate that was actually to go back to things that had been printed and recreate the Dale series from there, which is interesting and obviously not something you would do for except in extraordinary cases. So a lot of this is about how do you trust that the data that you can get now and the data that is at a URL is the same as it was before. This is very much what we were doing at Datamarkt back in the days. So we were gathering all sorts of mostly time series data, or our slogan was to find and understand data. So we helped people find, so we had a Google-like search to databases of statistical data, and then surface that in a uniform way. So you would go in, you'd type in search queries, and then you would find things like population connected to urban wastewater treatment, United Nations, electricity production, this is from the US EIA, transport of passengers, this comes from the Eurostat, the European Statistics Office, and so on. So we were gathering this type of data from about 250 organizations around the world. We had 150,000 data sets, and we were capturing the data in data format, in tabular structured format. It covered about 6,500 years of historical data, about a billion time series in there in total, and about 8 billion parts. So a part would be something like the temperature at Parker's Lake at 12 o'clock on May 1st and so on. So quite a lot of data there, but it was only a very, very small fraction of all of this type of data that exists. So one of the reasons I got kind of involved in these types of things was actually that we were working on a research project with a few research organizations on how to preserve exactly this kind of data, kind of how to go one level deeper into the type of systems that publish this. Because the origin of the tool, with about 250 organizations that we were capturing data from, and we probably had 249 different ways of accessing the data. There were Excel sheets, they were differently formatted, there were proprietary systems, even the proprietary systems that were used in the same systems, they were differently kind of configured and so on. So there's a lot of things to think about there. And again, this all relates back, all of this, there's a story in every single piece of data. And to kind of prove that out, I kind of have a couple of my favorite stories here. So this is electricity use in Iceland in gigawatt hours. So the blue line is household consumption, and the orange line is heavy industry. So with mountains and lots of water and lots of geothermal energy, we are somewhat research-oriented economy. And you can see that kind of back in the late 90s, we had the heavy industries at a certain level, and you had the household industry at a certain level. Even just the kind of big picture here shows you the amount of stuff of kind of heavy industry, kind of the growth of heavy industry in the two decades that the data covers here. But there are other kind of more subtle facts here, and it goes back to kind of you have to think about all sorts of things when you're looking at the data. So you notice these kind of regular dips here. So these are mostly aluminium smelters and kind of big factories that go 24/7. You don't want them to kind of fluctuate and so on. So there's obviously a kind of regular dip here. Once a year, the energy consumption drops significantly. Anybody care to guess what that is? Christmas?
Summer.
Mm-hmm. So for the household, this is kind of the annual swing. So that's what you're seeing there. You're seeing the seasons. If I tell you this is February, does that give you any hint? No. February has 10% fewer days than the other months. There's 28 days on average, 29 in some cases. So, it's just good to show that you have to be very careful when you are kind of looking at data. I always laugh when I hear somebody point out that that some number was, let's say, credit card spending was, 0.5% less this year than the same month last year. Okay? how many weekends were there in that month this year versus last year. So these types of comparisons are really have to be really carefully considered. Now this one is not. This one has some strange characters in it. So anyway, so this is another data set. This is to show you that by bringing together different data sets, you can tell a story as well. So these are translating what it says up there. These are actually Icelandic telcos and their prevalence in the or their kind of market share. It's an age pyramid, and the gray is showing the overall age pyramid, the overall age composition of the country, and the colored parts are showing their customers. So you can see this is the old incumbent, mostly have old people or older people. This was kind of a Vodafone goes for like a family strategy, so they have people in all ages. Tal is another one, similar strategy, the same shape but just smaller. And then this was the kind of youth kind of newcomer that went into the youth market. These are people that do not have cell phones, so they are. This is male, this is female, so it's only old women that don't have telephones. And then the last one is showing something else. So the kind of the story here is by combining data about the actual kind of research that was done by Kapasen, which is the Gallup representative in Iceland, and the statistics from Statistics Iceland, you get in a single picture a very kind of easy to understand overview of that market. The last story I want to tell you, so again, yet another Icelandic story, but this is the population of Iceland from the early 1700s. So we've had our share of diseases and eruptions and people moving abroad and so on. So you can see some small deaths here. It's about 15% of the population that died off in the late 1700s, though, so these are significant. But you can also see that for some reason I'm leaving room up there. So this is the number of sheep. So you can see that they outnumber us quite by a factor of 500. But there are still some interesting things here. So first of all, the data isn't quite as frequent to begin with, but there's also this one point in time where we outnumber them. And that was in the beginnings of the events that were happening here in the late 1700s, where, it was a big volcanic eruption once more, and it killed off more of the sheep than it did of the people. So for a short while, they had the upper hand. Anyway, so that brings me to one more point. So I was thinking this morning, if some of you are on Twitter and you've been watching the hashtag for the event, you might have seen. So I tweeted with the hashtag, and I was wondering, is it more valuable? Do we learn more from reading today's newspaper? I'm going to say newspaper here, or a newspaper from 30, 50, 100 years ago? So, and you know, there is no definite answer to that. But the reason I started thinking about that, for some reason, all of my stories are about volcanoes. The reason I was thinking about that is that somebody dug up a 40-year-old newspaper article, and it was actually a letter to the editor of the biggest newspaper in Iceland. There had been a big eruption on a small island south of Iceland. It had a population of about 5,000 people, and they had to be evacuated overnight. So they were all coming to Reykjavik, where there was a housing crisis because the economy was going quite well, and they didn't keep up building enough houses there. So the letter to the editor literally says, "We can't have all these people from Vestmannaeyjar, which is a small island, less than 100 kilometers away from the capital. We can't have all these people come here. There's no room. We have to build for our own people first." And I thought that was interesting because have exactly the same conversation that's going on today, but the people are just further away. They're in Syria, they are in northern Africa, and so on. It, you know, what it brought up, brought home to me was, we never say that today about people that live 100 kilometers away, but we're happy to say it about people that come from 10,000 kilometers away. So it was kind of just an interesting lesson in reading an old newspaper, but also in the context, because just browsing through that newspaper, you see what somebody found worthy pointing out, writing up, and printing in a piece of paper at that point in time. So no matter how seasoned you are in history, you will learn something new from reading that. Now, in the born digital age, what will that experience be 4 years from now? How can you go back to kind of capture the spirit of the day if you want, 4 years from now? Which is, and I'm not saying one is better than the other, it's just how would we recreate that? Even with full preservation of all digital artifacts, how do you kind of, how do you get to that experience? Or is it possible? Anyway, the final piece here is about, there's also data coming out of more and more things. The Internet of Things is a big thing, it's a big kind of hype word, but people say that there will be machine data connections will outnumber the human data connections by a factor of at least 10, if not, if not more than that. So light bulbs are kind of gathering data about, the energy consumption when they're on and so on. Cars, all sorts of, basically all of our things are already gathering data, and a lot of that data will become online. And, is any of that worth saving? Interesting thing there is that you have this kind of flow of data, and there's no way, even with the storage capacity that we have today, and the kind of cheap computing power and so on, there's absolutely no way to store all of this data. It's impossible. But we know that some of it we want to store, some of it we want to analyze and so on. So it's going to be super important in that world to have equipment that can take a split-second decision about what to store and what to throw away. Most of it you're going to discard, some of it you want to store, and some of it you want to analyze in real time. You want, something interesting is happening and so on. So there are, this is a problem in industry, but it will probably be a problem in kind of, you could kind of draw this to different types of skills. This is in general the my father-in-law or my mother-in-law question, and what do you want to do with all the data that's coming your way? What is important? The surprising thing then is that you never know what will come out of these types of things. So the most one of the more interesting things that are happening in the computer world or in the software world these days is artificial intelligence. So this is from from earlier this year, when a computer beat the best Go player in the world. So chess had been kind of conquered before and so on. So artificial intelligence is becoming super good at certain tasks. So it's beating humans in ever more kind of concentrated small tasks, like playing chess or Go, driving a car, reading a reading an X-ray photo. Those types of tasks computers are becoming, and or if they haven't already become, better than human experts are doing. The only reason for that is that it can build on a lot more experience than a single human being, meaning it has access to all the data that trains it to become good at these tasks. So a lot of land grab is going on now in terms of just who has the best databases of these types of sorts. So in order to build the best self-driving car, whoever has the most data about driving cars will win, and about the kind of geography and about the landscape. And you will see unexpected uses for that. If we go back to, let's take an example that I know quite well. So let's say that you take all the fishing that happens around the island of Whiteland. If you had all the data about every single trawler and what they, where they were, what's the temperature of the ocean, How long did they kind of go for? How much fish did they capture? What was the fish they captured, and so on? If you could kind of bring all of that together, you could train a neural network to be better than an individual captain at going after, you know, fish and fishing for it. So those types of things will happen, and people would use good archetypes to do these types of things, and some of these things will be super valuable. You just don't know which things yet. So the takeaway is here, there's more to archiving and news archiving or otherwise than just the web itself. We didn't even talk about mobile apps and other things where the digital content is very hard to get at. Hoarding is not a strategy. You can't capture everything. You have to have some rule of thumb in what you keep and what you throw away. And thirdly, you can only guess what will be important in the future. And it can be very surprising what will be important in the future. So this is from a newspaper in 1927. This is from the front page of the New York Times. I don't remember the exact date, but it's in 1927. It's the third sub-headline on the same main headline in that paper. And anybody care to guess what this is about? You got it. Television. So, you know, somebody had, so they had the president kind of appear in the first broadcast of television. He spoke to, you know, people across that. They just imagine how amazing that must have been. But they were like, how is anybody going to use that? I mean, yeah, it's cool, but, you know, does it have any applications? So, you know, it's just to kind of point out the fact that we have no clue what, we can only guess what will be important in the future. So, these are the three things that I want you to take away, and I've blown away most of my time, if not more than it. Do you want to take some questions? Or
three quick questions.
Okay.
Magic number. We welcome Dr. Coffey if you ask questions.
Okay, we have a question in the back.
Repeating
the question. So essentially, the kind of hoarding is not a strategy resonates well with the librarians, with the Facebookists, you know, even with paper. Now you have more and more data coming your way. And kind of is there a way that is, you know, it's an overlap between data science and librarians, and, you know, is there what could that relationship look like? So first of all, I think you are absolutely right. The best, but not, you know, far from perfect solution is probably trying to bring data science into that somehow. I would dare to say that probably just because of funding issues and other things like that, industry may be a little bit ahead in some of these things. So I would look to a lot of the strategies that have already been applied in industry and kind of see to what degree they apply there. The problem with these things is number of skilled people and, you know, how costly they are. So that's really kind of the big problem, because I think that it's like any kind of cross-disciplinary mind meld. If you have people that know what they're doing in two different areas or functional areas, something great can come out of that. So I think it's more about the problem to solve is how do you get to the data scientists, and how do you get them to kind of listen and take notice of your problem? Because as soon as they do, I think that even in kind of just the very first things that could come out of that could be super valuable, and they could probably be done quickly and relatively cheaply. So it's about kind of getting the attention of the right people and getting them together in a room for a day. That's not an answer, but it's maybe a method.
Yes, I have a question. I'll be speaking tomorrow a little bit about the Vietnam War, about the actual coverage of the war. But since then, there's been 50,000, 60,000 books written about the war by participants, historians, and in fact, history book won the Pulitzer last year, and this year a novel on Vietnam won the Pulitzer Prize. Is there any idea of how to integrate what we learn after these events with what is actually happening at the time, even though at the time there was an enormous amount of material come back? How do you integrate it all to get the historical perspective?
Yeah. That's a super interesting question. I'm not going to claim I have the answer, but...
Can you summarize the question?
Yeah, so summarizing the question, we're going to be talking tomorrow about the Vietnam War and the archives of some of the news coverage there, but there have also been tens of thousands of books written about the subject, so, you know, probably taking different parts of it or summarizing and kind of bringing some of those things together, but how could you potentially integrate some of the overview material with the news coverage of the day. Is that a fair summarization?
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things is that obviously perspective always comes with time. So you need certain amount of time to kind of start to consolidate and start to really understand what was going on and kind of you get additional pieces of information there, which is often backed up by this. And with archives and with the possibility to preserve a lot of this, and I imagine that some of what we'll be talking about is that we were at risk of losing some of the base material, or at least it wasn't easily accessible. So it's the same problem as Martin and I were talking this morning about scientific papers. So scientific papers are archived in a fairly good way, but everything they reference, especially if it's online, is a problem. And all the data they reference and all the data they publish as kind of supplements to that is a problem. So I think that it's a little bit akin to the same thing. It's and you know, now that everything is digitally born, so obviously first you have to solve the problem of how do you archive it at all. But you will definitely see new possibilities in the fact that you can. I think the book will look very similar in 4 years to what the book looks like today. But you will have the possibility to reference also to supplementary material and assume that people can get to it. So the difference there being that now, or at least 20 years ago, when you published the book, you would be referencing things that you would have to dig hard in a really good research library to be able to even get at what's being referenced. But, you know, 4 years from now, hopefully with a good archive, you can assume that if somebody wants to take the deeper dive on something you're referencing in a piece of a kind of an overview piece, that they can get at it. And that would be, you know, the experience will be different. I imagine that we may jump more back and forth. I find this with myself when I'm reading a book. I find myself taking up my phone and Googling for something because I need more depth or want more depth on what I'm reading about. And I'm sure that will be kind of almost built into any such overview literature that we'll see in the future. Last question.
Where do you say the fittest of expertise are for the topic you're discussing? Are there any regions or areas?
So the question is, are there any centers of concentration or kind of excellence on some of the topics that are being discussed here? And I think we're in. No, so I mean partly. So the IIPC conference that I was at in April is definitely probably one of the higher concentrations you find of people that A, are thinking about the problem, and B, have solved the skills to do that. I think what is needed is that we need more people that come from the technical side of things to just, you know, pay attention to this problem and start applying some of the things they know there. And the good thing about us nerds is that we are often easily pursued by other things than money. We kind of, you know, we take interest in weird things. And I think that, you know, so for example, in the, I don't know if you know of a group called Hacks Hackers. So it's a meetup group that happens all over the US and probably in other places in the world as well, where number one thing it's about is to take the hacks, the journalist hacks, and the hackers, the kind of the computer nerds, and just bring them together for beer. You know, that's more or less the purpose. Once a month. But you know, there's always a speaker. They talk. But a lot of really interesting data journalism stuff has come out of that. So I think this type of kind of maybe outreach over to the technical side is probably, it's a little bit akin to the first question. It's like, how do you get those people interested in the problem? Because as soon as they do, things can happen, you know, with a modest amount of kind of money and sometimes not so modest amount of work, but they're willing to put that in. So we're way over time. So
thank you.
Thank you so much. And if you're not interested in money, I think this is a good area. we're going to take a break. I think we will try to just take a 10-minute break instead of 15. And we'll remind people that you need to earn your supper a little bit. There are some sheets just outside the door here with questions. Please leave your thoughts about the questions. Bathrooms, again, are you going to go down the hall, down the stairs, to your right. Enjoy the break. I will see you at 10:25.